Welcome to the weekly geology seminar this week. Actually, we're going to have another one tomorrow. But as many of you know, for many years I taught environmental geology here in the department, and one of my particular interests was in mining impacts, environmental impacts of mining. So I am particularly anxious and pleased to be able to welcome Dr. David Blows here. David is the Ritzold Rice Distinguished Lecturer, sponsored by the Hydrogeology Division of the Geological Society of America. He received his education, both a bachelor's degree and master's and PhD at the University of Waterloo in Ontario. And he has been on the faculty since then there in the Department of Earth Sciences. He holds the Canada Research Chair in Groundwater Remediation at the University of Waterloo. And this has been his main interest of research and teaching. He has many publications and books, and so he is a very yes, very welcome expertise for us here in this particular time and place in Minnesota. So I'd like you to welcome David Blows.
It's a pleasure to be here. I'm happy to come. This is, as John mentioned, the Bertholdt Rice Distinguished Lecture, and the Bertholdt Rice Lecture is sponsored by the Hydrogeology Division of the Geological Society of America. And it honors two people, John Bertholdt, in whose name the original bequest was made, and then Shirley Bryce, who was a lecturer in 1992 and was killed in a tragic car crash in 1993, so the lecture was expanded to include her name as well. So I want to put my acknowledgments up front in case I forget to put them at the end. So the sponsor is the Geological Society of America, the Hydrogeology Division, and the University of Waterloo, where I work, is giving me time to travel around the country and give this talk and another talk. And my colleagues are picking up the slack, and thank them. These are the people who've done most of the work on the projects that I'll describe, and these two people, Carol Potocic and John Jambor, are people that I've worked with on every project that I'll talk about, and the others have worked on most of the projects I'm talking about. This line of people here are technicians who've worked with me for more than 10 years, and they're people who pick up projects after graduate students leave, and they take over and continue to build good data sets that we've got. And I'm usually graduate students who work on the projects, and they're the ones who really did most of the work and deserve most of the credit and all of the blame for it. We've got a good amount of funding from, these are government agencies here. This is the Canadian equivalent of NSF Ontario. These are Canadian federal programs. We've got support from Manitoba, and we also have a fair amount of support from mining companies. So a lot of the projects that we're working on, the mining companies contribute to through matching grants between NSERC and the mining companies. So when we mine, we excavate huge holes in the ground, and most of the material that we take out of the ground ends up being waste. So the types of waste that we produce are the waste rock, that is, you know, the big chunks of rock that you excavate in order to get access to the ore body. Then you refine the ore and produce a concentrate, and that produces mill tailings. And then you refine that concentrate to produce a metal, and that produces refinery waste, things like jarosites or ferric oxides, things like that. And then off the mine site, you should get metal finishing waste, and we have a part of our program that's focused on that as well. To mine from a low-grade copper deposit, you end up recovering 1 ton of copper for 99 tons of waste. So by far, the majority of material that comes out of the ground ends up being waste. If you're mining gold or diamonds or something like that, then the ratio is even worse. Almost everything that comes out of the ground ends up being waste. So these are the types of waste that we're working on. This is mine working in northern Manitoba, where we have our project underway. This is the waste rock that came out of the mine. This is the mill tailings that came after the processing of the ore body, of the ore. And this is the slag that came after the metal was produced from the concentrate. In Canada, we have about 10,000 abandoned mines, and we expect to spend somewhere between $2 and $5 billion to clean that up. We're currently producing about 1 million tons of waste rock and 1 million tons of mill tailings in a day. In the U.S., you have about 100,000 abandoned mines, 400,000 hectares of reservoirs impacted by mine drainage, 19,000 kilometers of rivers and streams, and the estimated cleanup costs are on the order of $32 to $76 billion. If you compare these costs to these costs, either we're much more effective or much more naive than anything else. You can just talk about either of those two. To put this kind of in context, there's two mines that we've worked at, one in Iron Mountain in California, and then Kennecott site in Utah, that each have values that are come close to $1 billion, between $500 million and $1 billion in cleanup costs. So that's just for two mines. So this is a pretty optimistic number. The first waste that I'll talk about, or material I'll talk about, is mill tailings. That's where I spend most of my time working on through the years. That comes in large volumes of really finely grained material. It's high sulfide content, up to about 85% weight of the tailings in sulfide. And it's rich in the iron sulfides, pyrite and pure type, and by far the most abundant of those is pyrite. And that's because those minerals have no commercial value. You can't extract iron from those at a viable cost. The way that tailings are deposited is in a pipeline that's discharging the tailings into this impoundment here. This is surrounded by a retaining dam. And that dam is designed to retain solids but not water. So there's a collection ditch at the bottom of this dam that allows water to flow through it. And there's a continue to flow through the dam and out into the surface water flow system. But that water is collected and then diverted back to the mine during operations. Ultimately, the entire impoundment will be filled with solids. The tailings will be allowed to drain and consolidate. And the consolidation of the tailings is part of the way that you maintain their stability. So the closeout for this impoundment and many dozens of others is similar to this, where you have a water table at some depth below the ground surface. The tailings consolidate and drain. In a lot of places where we're working, the tailings are placed on top of permeable sediments. In many cases, deliberately on top of permeable sediments because that helps them consolidate and drain faster. So there's water that goes through the base of the impoundment into the unconsolidated sediments underneath and then discharges some distance downgrade from the discharge point. So this is the type of tailings impoundment that was built, say, between the 1950s and the 1990s. So there's more stringent containment that's been imposed since the 1990s, but the bulk of the tailings impoundments that are in place that we've worked on are just about like this. As the water table falls and an unsaturated zone or Beto zone develops, and that allows oxygen to enter into the unsaturated zone and come in contact with the sulfide minerals. And that leads to sulfide oxidation reactions that reduces the contaminants that we're concerned about. The dominant controlling reactions are the oxidation of pyrite. Pyrite is the most abundant sulfide mineral, where oxygen and pyrite react, and that releases ferrous iron, Fe2 plus, sulfate, and hydrogen ions. And the ferrous iron can be oxidized to make ferric iron, but more oxidized iron. And that iron can react further with additional pyrite to generate more ferrous iron, more sulfate, and more hydrogen ions, or can precipitate as a ferric oxyhydroxide. This one is goethite, which is very abundant. And that addition releases additional hydrogen ions. In the field, we see these reactions occurring in the unsaturated zone of the tailings impoundment, the ferrous iron migrating along the groundwater flow path, and then this reaction occurring in the surface water flow system downstream. So this ferrous iron is the way that we move acidity along the groundwater flow path. All these reactions are slow, they're kinetically limited, they don't come deep with them very quickly. And these relationships describe the rate of these reactions under abiotic conditions. So when there's no bacteria present, this is for oxidation of pyrite by oxygen, by ferric iron in the presence of oxygen, and when oxygen is absent. What we realize is that all of these reactions are catalyzed by bacteria, and the most abundant of these bacteria is this one, Acetophilus sulfuroxidans. When we look at older tailings impoundments, those bacteria are always present. When we go to new places, what we see is a succession of bacterial types, starting with this one, which is Thiobacillus thioporus, and then that evolves to thioxidans, which is a neutral pH species. This has a predominance in the range between, say, 3.5 to 4.5, and then this is acidophilic, so this goes down to very low pH conditions. So these tend to establish conditions that are suitable for these ones, and then subsequently for these ones. And the bacterially catalyzed rates are very rapid, far more rapid, orders of magnitude more rapid than the abiotic rates. We go in the field and look at how sulfide minerals are oxidizing. This is the type of thing we see where we have a zone of oxidized sulfides at the top, a really narrow zone where the sulfides are actively oxidizing, and then a zone below that where there's almost no evidence of oxidation at all. And this zone, you know, a tailings contaminant can be 25 to 50 meters thick, it's usually between 10 and 15 centimeters thick. And it's remarkably uniform across the tailings contaminant and at a similar depth across the tailings contaminant. So it's really controlled by the diffusion of the gas down to the depth of active oxidation. We look at how the particles have changed. In the upper zone, it's completely replaced with the primary sulfides. Where the sulfides are oxidized, you see rims of oxidation plaques surrounding those grains. And then below that, we see almost no indication of oxidation at all. So at early stages, we have oxygen being consumed in the shallow portion of the contaminant with depletion of sulfides only at the top. At intermediate times, we have sulfides being depleted through most of the unsaturated zone and oxygen going quite deep into the unsaturated zone. And at late times, all the sulfides are oxidized above the water table, and the rate of oxidation is limited by the solubility of oxygen in the water that's below the water table. And that's quite low. The solubility of water in the oxygen water is about 8 milligrams per liter, which isn't really enough to generate a large environmental problem. So the implications of these field observations are the gas transport limits the oxidation rate at later times, and the gas transport is controlled by the diffusion coefficient. Diffusion is the dominant gas transport process, and that's controlled by the porosity of the waste and by the moisture content. This diagram shows that relationship between the degree of saturation and its diffusion coefficient. So for low degrees of saturation, you have high rates of diffusion. Once you're up to about 85 to 90% saturation, the diffusion coefficient drops sharply. If you want to maintain or prevent sulfur oxidation by maintaining a high moisture content, you need to be in this very high moisture content above about 90% saturation. So that's one of the things that we realized very early on. About a case study that we've been working on for the last few years, we just recently published on it. And that's at the Sheridan Mine near Thompson and Flin in northern Manitoba. And this is the mine in the period when it was operating in about the 1940s. The tailings were oxidizing for a period of about 70 years or so. The Sheridan Mine produced copper and zinc. It operated from 1932 to 1951. It produced 7.4 million tons of tailings. They cover an area of about 40 hectares. The primary sulfide minerals are pyrite and pyrrhotite. There's chalcopyrite, which is a source of copper, sphalerite, which is a source of zinc, and arsenopyrite, which is a source of arsenic. The total sulfide content of these tailings is about 25 to 30 weight percent. This is one arm of the tailings contaminant where we've done most of our studies, and most of the cross sections that I'll show are along this line here, and where I show data from an individual point. We make a whole variety of different types of measurements. These are barometers that we're installing for defining the groundwater flow system and taking water samples. Here we're sampling core gas concentrations in the unsaturated zone, and this is extracting core water from the unsaturated zone as well. This is the type of data that we generate. This is a profile through the tailings. This is the oxidized zone at the top. And this white zone here is where there's a lot of sulfate minerals precipitating, primarily gypsum and melanthite. And that cements the tailings. Where you see the sharp decline in the oxygen concentration where oxidation is actively occurring, and you can see that's really happening over a zone of about 10 or 15 centimeters. Above that, the sulfide mineral content is depleted, and above it, it's relatively uniform versus depth. There's some secondary enrichment of the sulfate that's here. That's primarily where the sulfate minerals are precipitating. This is the groundwater flow system within the impoundment. This is the top of the impoundment here. This is the water table. These black lines here are groundwater flow lines, so water is flowing from the center portion of the impoundment and discharged into the lake downstream. The colors show the concentrations of tritium. Tritium was released to the atmosphere during the 1960s through atmospheric testing of nuclear weapons. And so these high concentrations of tritium here are derived from the bomb testing in the 1960s. And that gives us an age of groundwater along the groundwater flow path. So this is the 60s water, 1960s water, and lots is on the order of 4 to 10 meters per year. So the water is moving relatively slowly through the impoundment and then discharging into the lake downstream. There's very low pH conditions in the unsaturated zone of the impoundment. The pH is between 0.7 and 2 at the top of the impoundment, and that gradually increases. Down here where the water is discharging, there's carbonate minerals residing in the impoundment, that's buffering the pH back up to close to neutral. There's very oxidized conditions at the top of the impoundment and reduced conditions at the base. The alkalinity is essentially absent in the unsaturated zone and below the water table, the shallow water table, but there's alkalinity remaining in the deeper portion of the impoundment. The primary change in pH is due to the dissolution of carbonate minerals and aluminum silicate minerals. And you can see very low masses of carbonates. This is 0.05 weight percent at the top, at the maximum here. The acidic conditions are obliterated biotite from the unsaturated zone. And spectrite, there's only a small amount of chloride residing in the unsaturated zone as well. This is the style of aluminum silicate dissolution that's occurring. This is a grain of L-pipe, and you can see the weathering here where the base cations have been removed or have been leached from that rim that surrounds the primary grain. This is the same thing here. And this is a grain of cordierite, and this narrow rim that surrounds it is the more silica. So almost everything but the silica is being leached from the unsaturated zone of the impoundment. You see very high concentrations of iron sulfate, with over 100 grams per liter of dissolved iron, and over 200 grams per liter of dissolved sulfate in the unsaturated zone of the impoundment. Zinc and aluminum concentrations are very high, with up to about 55 grams per liter of dissolved zinc in the unsaturated zone up here, and up to about 7 grams per liter of dissolved aluminum in the unsaturated zone. Copper concentrations are up to about 1.5 grams per liter, but are really limited to the shallow unsaturated zone. That's because copper is reprecipitating in the unsaturated zone as a secondary copper sulfide mineral pebblite. Nickel concentrations are much lower, up to about 15 milligrams per liter. In addition to the dissolved constituents, we see large masses of secondary precipitates that are accumulating. This is gypsum, soluble iron sulfates, that is principally melanthrite, jarosite, which is a iron hydroxysulfate mineral, and gophite, which is iron hydroxide, or oxyhydroxide. And there's large masses of these minerals accumulating in the unsaturated zone, so long after sulfide oxidation is complete, those minerals will still be there and dissolving and releasing dissolved minerals to the waters that flows through the impoundment. This is the surface of the impoundment, and this green material that's accumulated here in these tire tracks is melanthrite, which is iron sulfate with 7 waters attached to it, and has a solubility of about 1 mole per liter. This is white precipitated polyphenardite, which is more soluble than melanthrite. The pH in this zone is about 3.2, and there's very high concentrations of iron sulfate and dissolved metals in the water that's seeping out of the basin or the side of the impoundment. That water collects and then discharges to this small pond that's here, which has a very attractive red color to it. That water then flows into here and discharges into a larger lake, and we can see the effect of this tailings impoundment about 16 kilometers in a quite a good quality lake downstream. So we see the effect of the weathering of the tailings impoundment far downstream. This water is discharged from this lake has a pH of about 2.5 and high concentrations of iron sulfate and dissolved metals as well. We compare this to other sites that we've worked on in Canada, United States, and in Europe. So this is Teesteel in New Brunswick, where the pH goes down to about 1. There's very high concentrations of iron sulfate and copper and zinc. This is an Iron Mountain where the pH goes as low as minus 3.6. There's extremely high concentrations of iron and sulfate. This is Genalunas, a site in Sardinia that we've been working on, where the pH is down 0.6. Very high concentrations of iron sulfate and dissolved metals. And this is Sheridan, which fits pretty well into this population of extreme water conditions. Part of what we wanted to do in developing our research program was be able to predict in the future when we have problems associated with mine waste sites. So we've developed a reactive solute transport model, a computer model that we can use to describe these reactions and help us predict when we're going to have contaminated water associated with these sites. This model describes water and solute transport in unsaturated and saturated porous media. We have what we call a partial equilibrium formulation, so we can describe reactions either controlled by kinetic rates or else by equilibrium. We have direct substitution of the chemical reactions into the transport equations, which is a very inefficient, but effective way of coupling those equations. And we can incorporate the site-specific geochemical conditions. We can include the chemical reactants that we see there and the minerals that we see in their abundances, and we can define reaction rates either from laboratory studies or from the literature. This is the nickel rim tailings impoundment in northern Ontario, which is just outside of Sudbury, about 5 or 7 kilometers from the Sudbury Airport. This impoundment has been revegetated, and the revegetation program has been very effective. Vegetation is well established in this portion of the impoundment. If you turn around from where that picture came, this is more of a typical site that you'd see at a mine waste site, and this is just on the other side of the hill where the vegetation program hasn't been anywhere near as successful. The tailings mineralogy here is primarily pyrrhotite. This is a nickel mine, and one of the primary nickel-bearing minerals is pyrrhotite. There's also chalcopyrite and pentlandites. This is a copper sulfide, and this is a nickel iron sulfide. The primary buffering mineral is calcite, calcium carbonate, and these are till aluminum silicate minerals like anorthite and biotite, so a feldspar and a micaceous mineral. The secondary minerals that we see at the site are cobalite, which is a secondary copper sulfide. This is jarosite, which is a iron hydroxide sulfate, gypsum, which is a calcium sulfate, and then iron hydroxide, aluminum hydroxide, and amorphous silica. This is a cross section through the impoundment. The impoundment is about 10 hectares in area. It's about 8 meters in thickness. There's a groundwater flow divide right in here. So half the water flows this way and about half the water flows that way. On this side of the flow divide, about half the water flows into the sand aquifer and half discharges directly at the base of the impoundment. On this side, about half discharges at seepage faces along this flank here, and about half goes into an aquifer that discharges downstream. The pHs in the top of the impoundment range between 2.5 and 3.5, and then because the calcite's there, the pH rises with increasing depth to between 6 and 6.5. And that pH really controls the transport of dissolved constituents through the impoundment. The aluminum concentrations are affected by the change in pH, and as the pH rises from about 3.5 to about 4.5, the concentration decreases from about 300 milligrams per liter down to less than 10 milligrams per liter. So you have a really narrow zone where the bulk of aluminum is coming out of the water. Nickel is similar, but at a different pH range. So when pHs go from about 5.5 to about 6, the nickel concentrations drop from about 250 milligrams per liter to less than 10 milligrams per liter. So quite a sharp drop in pH or in nickel concentrations as a result of adsorption due to the change in pH. So in our simulations, we first describe the rate of sulfide oxidation and oxygen consumption. So that's the reaction that drives the overall process. And this is a series of simulations that we did in the mid-1990s with a model called MINTOX that was developed by Murray Wunderlich when he was one of our graduate students. So the input for this model is the moisture content and the total sulfide content. This is a comparison here of the measured gas concentrations and speed points and the simulated results from the model. So we get good agreement between our observations and our simulations. We also see depletion of the sulfides in the unsaturated zones, very similar to what we see in the field. This is a comparison of the sulfate and iron concentrations. So we can describe the release of iron and sulfate quite well. The sulfate concentrations in the simulations are similar to what we see in the field, and the iron concentrations are quite similar. The iron and sulfate are being released by the oxidation of the pyrrhotite, and the iron is being reprecipitated by precipitation or reaccumulated by precipitation of ferrihydrite, which is an iron oxide, and jarosite, which is the basic iron sulfate. The nickel and copper concentrations are simulated reasonably well. This is the nickel concentrations, and that's released by the oxidation of pyrrhotite and pentlandite. And the nickel concentrations continually increase down to a depth of greater than 4 meters. We see depletion of pentlandite in the unsaturated zone, and depletion of chalcopyrite, and we also see the rise in the concentration of cobalite. So that limits the high concentrations of copper for the very shallow portion of the unsaturated zone. We see reasonably good agreement between our observed and simulated pH values, with pHs in the unsaturated zone between 3 and 3.5, and the primary buffering minerals are the carbonates and aluminum silicates that are releasing calcium and magnesium. And we see quite good agreement between the predicted concentrations of calcium and the predicted concentrations of magnesium and the concentrations that we measure in the field. In addition, we've done a comparison between the solid phase masses that we measured from samples that we've taken in the field and our simulation results. So we see depletion of pyrrhotite in the unsaturated zone. This is data from 2 points in the center portion of the impoundment. We see the accumulation of gypsum, similar to what we see in the field. We kind of over-predicted the gypsum accumulation. And we see good agreement with the iron oxides as well, the iron oxyhydroxides. So we have three phases, really, the dissolved aqueous phase, the solid phase, and the gas phase. And we see reasonably good agreement with all of those in between what we simulated and what we've observed in the field. So we've used our simulations to really look at how long sulfide oxidation will occur and where the bulk of the reactions are, when the bulk of the reactions are occurring. I had a marked 1997 period, because that was when we were starting to work on this project. And at that time, the mining company who was working at the site or owned the site was considering putting the cover on top of the impoundment to stop sulfide oxidation. So we compared our simulation or looked at our simulation results to see if that would give them any idea whether spending the money on the cover was worthwhile. So we realized that really the bulk of the oxidation occurred in the first 20 years. So by the time it got to 1997, the tailings were deposited between 1950 and 1958. It was really too late to solve that problem by putting a cover on the top. So the cat was out of the bag, or the horse was out of the barn, or some animal was out of some sort of agreement. But really, if you're going to add a cover, you have to do it right here in the first 5 or 6 years after the tailings are put down. By the time you're 4 years out, it's way too late to manage the problems in that approach. So this again is the scenario that we see at a lot of places where we're working, where we have oxidation occurring in the unsaturated zone and transport of oxidation products along the groundwater flow path and discharge to the surface water flow system many decades after the oxidation reaction has ended. So this may be occurring over a period of say 50 to 100 years, but transport along here may take another 50 to 100 years on top of that. So you may not realize that this will be a problem until many decades after the source is really wound down. So this is release of ferrous iron to a surface water marsh in a site in northern Manitoba, and this is release of a copper-containing effluent from an aquifer site in northern Australia. So at both of these places, you really couldn't anticipate that these would happen on the basis of just looking and monitoring the surface water chemistry. You have to go in and look at the groundwater chemistry and how the sulfides are oxidizing within the waste. The other type of waste that's associated with mining is waste rock, and that's really received a lot less attention than mill tailings at mine sites. With large volumes of waste rock, typically on the same order as the mill tailings, it has a much lower sulfide content, so where tailings can be up to about 85 waste rock, 5 waste rock, so this waste rock is at the site of the saturated tends to provide preferential flow. In unsaturated flow, it's really the fine grain matrix that provides the dominant portion of flow. There's some potential for bypass flow through the coarse fraction, but really this is about 85 to 90% of flow is through the fine fraction, which is really different than you see within tailings impoundments. We're collaborating with Lexan Smith from UBC and Dave Siegel from the University of Alberta and the Ansco people to look at scaling up measurements at a diamond mine in Northwest Territories. This is the Diavik diamond mine. This is in the middle of Lac de Grasse. So this area here is behind a dike, a retaining dike, and the kimberlite pipe that's at the bottom of the pit here was underwater prior to mining. So this line here on the outside is the dike that was constructed. This airstrip here is large enough to land a Hercules or a 737 on it, so that gives you an idea of the scale. This is our waste rock pilots here, and we're conducting our experiment at a little field facility that's over here. So our objective is to look at how we can take small-scale measurements and use them to predict what the behavior of a large-scale pile would be. So mining companies and their consultants usually use samples that are on the order of a kilogram to 10 kilograms and try and use those measurements to estimate how a very large rock pile will behave. In our study, what we're doing is looking at that size of pile or sample as well as larger scale samples at the same time. These samples are about 10 tons. And we're looking at larger scale test pads that are, contain about 70,000 tons of rock, and then we're comparing that to the full scale waste rock pile. So these are the types of laboratory studies that we're doing. This is a fairly standard community cell test. This is about 2 kilograms of rock that's subjected to weathering cycles of dry inlets, cycling event. Then we collect water from it once a week. These are test pads that we have that contain 10 tons of rock that are on site where the diamond mining is occurring. And we're building in very large scale test piles at the same site. So these are about 50 meters by 50 meters, and they'll be about 50 meters high at the end. So this is one test pile pad here, and this is another. And we're just finishing another one that's over here now. So we've lined the whole base of that so we can collect all the water that comes through that pile. We have a drain that's going through here. And then we have a series of lysimeters, places where we can collect water samples at the base of the pile. And each of these has a different size. So this is 2 meters by 2 meters, and these ones are 4 meters by 4 meters, and we combine them, they're 8 meters by 8 meters, and this one is 16 meters by 16 meters. So what, eight meters by 8 meters, this is 4 meters by 4 meters. So we want to see is how big a sample you have to collect before it's representative. So how big do these have to be before they give you an idea of what the water quality in the whole pile will look like? And then we're comparing that to the full-scale pile that's being constructed. We really instrumented these intensely, so these lines are different types of instrumentation. We have these lines here with these spiders that are coming off them for measuring the moisture content or collecting water samples from the pile. We have these continuous lines that are here that are used for geophysical instruments for measuring the porosity of the pile, the permeability of the air permeability and the water permeability, and for measuring the thermal conductivity of the rock. And then we have a whole series of samplers here for measuring the gas concentrations and the temperature. So we've set this up to collect a lot of data. This is just the same case from the different angles. We've got sampling devices that are all coming out of the top, and some interesting looking data collection stations. This is in an area of continuous permafrost, so we have to keep changing these of everything pipes here staying apart from our collection devices at the bottom of the pile, and everything goes into these trailers that are here at the bottom of the piles. And at those we have measurements of continuous measurements for electrical conductivity and pH. These are tipping bucket main gauges for measuring water volume, and then we have samplers back here that are collecting water samples for chemical analysis. We're just finishing off the construction of these piles, and our first sample is just coming out since about September or so. So this is the finished piles. This is one pile that's here, and another pile that's there, and the collection system is in here. In terms of remediation, there's a lot of sites where there's fairly severe contamination problems. Mining companies typically collect that water and treat it by producing high-density sludges. So that it's an ongoing process. They have treatment plants for their continually treating water. There's ways of preventing sulfide oxidation by putting covers on top of the piles, soil covers that have low oxygen diffusion coefficients or high moisture contents. There's a lot of work in Canada on covering waste with waters. With water, we have a favorable water balance for doing that, so we can flood the top of the waste and keep it flooded either by a contained system or by putting the waste in a lake. There's alternative covers, things like polyethylene or the Swedish government is looking a lot at using concrete. And then there's storm release covers that are used more and more in Australia, where you allow the water that falls on the surface during the wet periods of the year to evapotranspirate during the dry periods of the year. So you have really control on the amount of water that's going through the system, not the rate of oxidation. So a variety of different remediation processes that are passive. That includes constructed wetlands that are used extensively in warmer parts of the world, warmer than Canada anywhere. So they've been very effective in places like Northern Australia. They're used fairly extensively in the eastern part of the United States. And oxic limestone drains are drains that maintain the system anoxic, so you don't have oxidation of ferric iron. You have a limestone that neutralizes the water. There's a variety of different types of bioreactors or systems that treat water by biological processes. And the type of work that we're doing is permeable reactive barriers, where we excavate a portion of the aquifer and do the treatment system within the aquifer. So this is the type of system that we've been building, where you have the waste that's here and the plume of water that's moving down through the aquifer, and then we excavate a portion of that aquifer and replace it with material that will react with the contaminants in the plume. So we do the treatment within the aquifer prior to the water discharge into the surface water flow system. This is the first reactive area that we installed for feeding mine waste. This is again at the Nickel Rim site that I showed earlier, and this was installed by Sean Benner as part of his PhD thesis in 1997. He's installed in 95, this is from a paper from 1997. So the impoundment that I showed before is back over my shoulder, and there's an unconfined aquifer that moves, that's in a bedrock valley between there and this lake that's downstream. And the pH of the lake varies anywhere between about 3 and 5, and about 3 and about 5, depending on the time of year. So there's times we go and measure this lake, and the entire lake has a pH of somewhere between 2.5 and 3. The barrier that's here is composed of organic carbon, and the organic carbon was derived from the municipal recycling program from the city of Toronto. When we built this, there wasn't a recycling program in Sudbury, there is now. This is just sand that we used to hold up the trench, so the reactive portion of the barrier is this. We were able to dig right down the bedrock and install the barrier right on top of the bedrock. So you have this compost zone that's here, that's the reactive portion, then this sand is just holding up the side of the trench on the other side. So we installed this in 1995, and we've sampled it annually since then. We've installed probably about 50 of these types of remediation systems since then, but this is one that we monitor most closely, so that's why I like to show it. So we installed the barrier, the sulfate concentration of the plume was about 2,000 milligrams per liter, that's now up to about 4,000. The iron concentration was 500 milligrams per liter, that's up to about 2,000. The pH has stayed slightly acidic between 5.5 and 6. And there's almost no alkalinity in the water. The barrier is installed right on top of bedrock at the base of the valley. It's about 4 meters high. The reactive zone is about 15 meters across and about 4 meters this way. This is how the barrier sits within the aquifer. So the tailings impoundment is up here, the tailings dam is there. These yellow lines are the groundwater flow lines. And what this shows is that upstream of where we installed the barrier, there's discharge of groundwater to the surface and then re-infiltration of that water downstream. So we installed the barrier here at this bedrock high, and that was my decision, and it was a bad one. So we should have installed it back here where we would capture more of the water. But I decided to install it here because I wanted to save money. That's just a mistake. So we have water that's in this upper portion of the aquifer that hasn't been treated by the barrier. These lower diagram shows our sampling points downstream the barrier, within the barrier, and upstream the barrier. These are results from 2 years after the installation, and for sulfate, iron, and this is the acid generating potential. The sulfate reduction reaction removes sulfate from the water and precipitates metals as metal sulfides. The reaction also releases a lot of alkalinity. The bacteria that reduce the sulfate release a lot of alkalinity to the water, so it's the balance between the removal of iron and the release of alkalinity changes the acid generating potential. The sulfate concentration dropped by about 50%. The iron concentration is declined in this case by about 500 milligrams per liter to less than 50, and really usually less than a milligram per liter. So the water that's within the barrier and moving downstream has very low concentrations of dissolved iron. And the acid generating potential goes from being strongly acid producing upstream to being acid consuming within the barrier and downstream. So when this discharge is downstream, it will start to buffer the pH of the lake that's downstream from there. The sulfate reduction reaction is catalyzed by sulfate reducing bacteria. We've enumerated or characterized that bacterial population several times since we did the installation. This is from about 5 years after the installation. The blue line here is the number of sulfate reducers. This is at the upstream end of the barrier, in the middle, and the downstream end of the barrier. What we saw was high numbers of sulfate reducers all the way through the barrier. The red line is a measurement of dehydrogenase activity, which is an indicator of the overall bacterial activity. And at this time, we saw the highest level of activity in the center portion of the barrier, lower levels in the middle and downstream. We've gone back and resampled, and now we see a lower level of activity at the upstream end of the barrier with higher levels in the center portion of the barrier and increasing levels downstream. So we're gradually consuming the available organic carbon or reactive organic carbon at the upstream end of the barrier, the rate of reactions increasing downstream and the downstream portions of the barrier. The new pits that we saw look like this. This is a really poorly crystalline sulfide called macanite. And now we go back and sample now and see really well crystalline iron sulfides. This is iron sulfide mineral regite, and it's accumulated within the cellular structure of the organic carbon. And this is elemental nickel. So the conditions in the barrier are strong, reducing enough that nickel produces bioaccumulating in its elemental form, which is really not something that you expect to see. But there's a fairly easily detectable mass of elemental nickel within the barrier. We simulated the performance of this barrier also using the same reactive transport model. In this case, we combined the reactions that we recognized in the field and used rate expressions that we derived from our laboratory experiments. We have two sulfate reduction reactions. They both consume organic carbon and sulfate. They both produce alkalinity. This one produces hydrogen sulfide gas, and this one produces the elemental sulfur, which is also something we see in the field. The hydrogen sulfide is available to react with the metals to produce metal sulfides, and the alkalinity is available to react with the metals to produce metal carbonates. We see both of those, both metal carbonates and metal sulfides. A competing reaction is methanogenesis, where organic carbon is consumed, and methane and carbon dioxide are produced. So that competes for consumption of the organic carbon that's available. Then we have precipitation dissolution of calcite according to their equilibrium constants, aqueous compensation, and degassing. So we allow carbon dioxide and hydrogen sulfide to degas, because we can't match the pH of the water if we don't allow those to degas, to form bubbles and degas. This is the simulation setup, and it shows other characteristics of the barrier. So this is the ACFR upstream, and it has two layers. There's a low permeability layer at the top and a higher permeability layer at the bottom. And that is upstream of the barrier and downstream of the barrier. And then within the barrier, we have a variety of different zones. We have a zone of higher conductivity, hydraulic conductivity in the center portion of the barrier. And again, that's a construction error. So we want to have the barrier as uniform as possible. We have zones of low permeability at the top and the bottom, and a zone of higher permeability in the middle, which isn't something that we wanted to have. Boundary conditions are the hydraulic head at the tailings impoundment at the top, no flow in this zone here, water flowing through the barrier, and then recharge from the top of the aquifer downstream of where the barrier is. This is the groundwater flow net, where the lines are closer together is where velocities are higher. So we have high velocity in the base of the aquifer, in the center portion of the barrier, then back down in the base of the aquifer. Then we have water flowing from the top of the aquifer and recharging the aquifer downstream. These are the boundary conditions for transport, so we have tailings dry water flowing through the upstream end of the barrier and then recharge of surface water at the top of the aquifer. So our simulation results compare reasonably well with our field measurements. We see removal of sulfate within the barrier, removal of iron, production of hydrogen sulfide, reduced alkalinity, and the increase in the pH. So all very similar to what we see in the field. We have the same minerals precipitating. This is macanite, which is the poorly crystalline iron sulfide, siderite, which is the iron carbonate, elemental sulfur, and gypsum. In the simulations, we have more sulfur than we see in the field and less gypsum than we see in the field. So we need to do some additional work on the simulations. We sampled the barrier in detail for the first 4 or 5 years after it was installed when Sean Benner was doing his PhD, and we saw a variety of different things happening. There's an increase in the dissolved iron concentrations at the upstream end of the barrier. We saw this zone of preferential flow in the center portion of the barrier becoming more and more apparent, and we saw a gradual decline in the rate of reaction of the organic carbon material. As a result of all those things, we started to see higher concentrations of dissolved iron being discharged from the downstream end of the barrier. We look at the rate of percent of removal of sulfate and iron and production of alkalinity through time, and we see overall a gradual decline in the rate of sulfate reduction and sulfate removal and iron removal. But on top of that, we see a far more substantial annual change in the rate of sulfate reduction. And we think that there's a lot of overall reaction, so we can temperature correct our rate coefficients. So we can now look at how the temperature variation affects the degree of sulfur and extent of sulfate reduction versus time. This shows those types of simulations where we have results from January, fall, July, and September. So these are the colder months and these are the warmer months. You see much less sulfur reduction in the wintertime when temperatures are cold, and much more extensive sulfur reduction in the summertime when temperatures are warm. It's very similar to what we see in the field. We've also gone back and taken cores of the barrier versus time to look at the massive sulfides that are accumulating. So early on, we saw a really rapid rate of sulfide accumulation, but after about a year or so, that declined to a much slower rate, and that's stayed the same or varied by about a factor of 2 since then. We've also seen a more extensive or more substantial decline rate at the leading edge of the barrier. So we are, again, are seeing a more rapid removal of the reactive organic carbon at the leading edge of the barrier. So we're gradually depleting the reactive material within the barrier. So we combine those effects in a final set of simulations. So we look at the rates of sulfate reduction, how they vary versus temperature, and how the reactivity of organic carbon versus time, and then the change in the input concentration of dissolved iron and sulfate. We put all those factors together, we can simulate the performance of the barrier reasonably well. So the smooth curve is our simulation results, and the pink spots are points our field measurements will be made. So we have a reasonably good agreement between our measurements and our modeling results. So an overall conclusion then, in the least of acidic drainage, you can continue at mine sites for many decades to many centuries. The mines that drove the Greek Empire, the Roman Empire, and the Vikings are all still releasing dissolved metals. We think that reactive barriers are providing alternative to conventional collection and treatment systems for treating mine drainage. And we think that reactive transport models that we've been working on are beneficial for understanding duration and quality of acidic drainage, for evaluating remedial options, and for understanding the performance and limitations of our treatment systems. So, some papers, and thank you. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Okay. Did it look like your reactive barrier was kind of exhausted after something in the order of 7 to 8 years, maybe? Is there a way to regenerate that?
Yeah, it was about 9 years is the limit of that barrier. And we'll go back and install a new barrier in the same place. We may not actually do that because that aquifer is actually a pretty good porous medium, and there's a mine that's developing around the bend, and they may want to use it for backfill. So that's we're discussing with the mine company whether we can reinstall on there or give us another second work time. So, yeah, well, we would expect that barrier to last for a decade or so. So some barriers will last much longer, some won't last that long. So a reactive barrier is a system that you install and you go away and you come back. It's not that you install and you go away, you have to come back. It'll last forever. It's not a walkaway solution.
Yeah. Sort of a related question to the minimal barriers. The situation that you showed, or one of them, was sort of a channelized flow at bedrock, a sort of trough going into it, and then there was a lip or a berm that was buried on.
Right.
So it's kind of a limited flow situation. Would that kind of barrier scale up to less ideal kinds of systems, you think, pretty well? Or is there a limitation to how large a volume you can put through that kind of?
Yeah. That's a lot of questions. Okay, so the first question is, we don't need to have a confining zone to contain the barrier. So as long as the barrier is more permeable than the aquifer around it, people can get water through it. So we have lots of barriers that aren't confined by anything, just hanging within the aquifer. So the plume is, at some depth in the aquifer, we install the barrier in front of that. There's lots of aquifer underneath it that's not treated at all.
Too long as you set it to catch it.
Yeah. You have to do a lot of plume definition before you can install a barrier. Probably more than you do with or certainly more than
Dr. Lewis, you measure iron and sulfides in downstream side of the barrier.
Yeah.
However, what about other heavy metals? Are you using the sulfur as a surrogate to all the other metals associated with acid mine drainage?
Yeah, and this literature has two talks. The other one's on reactive barriers. But we have barriers that are treating uranium, chromium, cadmium, zinc, lead, nickel, This barrier has about 30 milligrams per liter of nickel entering it, and the concentration downstream is below detection. So we have a whole variety of barriers that are treating many of the metals in the periodic table. Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does.
In one of your diagrams, you show a peat. Would that mean there's a reactive barrier?
We've had really limited success with peat. Peat is kind of what's residual after you take all the labile organic carbon away. So we're working with a group in Northern Saskatchewan and installed a barrier from peat a year ago, and it just hasn't worked at all. So we're trying to beef it up with more reactive material. And that's, you know, we've seen that a couple of places where peat just doesn't do it. It doesn't have enough reactivity to be effective.
Earlier in your presentation, you mentioned a tailings dike that allowed the water to pass through and contain the solids.
Yeah.
These are deliberately designed to allow water to pass. And my question is, I worked at MinCap 30 or 40 years ago up in the range, and now we've got 4 million gallons a day of salt base going into our drainage. So it's correct to assume that dike was designed to pass water to climate change.
I don't know about that one, but you know, I've worked on a few dozen of these, and most of them are built that way.
They were made with a coarse tailings from the mine process itself.
Yeah, a lot of them are waste rock with coarse tailings mixed. So, and the reason for that is that you want to drain the tailings as fast as you can so that the impoundment doesn't fall down. And that's, you know, water leaching through it is way better than the whole tailings impoundment falling down and flowing down the surface floor.
It's that iron mine.
Yeah, I don't know about that line. But we have lots where that's the design.
Other questions, thanks. You mentioned water cover treatment.
Yes.
Are there examples up other than Canada? And I guess my question is, if the water is oxygenated, does that cause more reactivity versus anoxic water, or how do you, is there much difference there?
Okay.
And is it effective?
Okay. There's some really well documented case studies, both of tailings that we put in lakes and impoundments that we built in 10 feet flush. So we've got really nicely developed case studies for impoundments that are flooded from the Elliott Lake area. So those were deliberately flooded, and they were built to be that way. And then there's tailings in northern Manitoba that were deposited at the bottom of lakes. And I know whether that was intentional or not, but they're there. And they've been studying in fairly good detail. So those types of systems are really well characterized. The question about the mass of oxygen dissolved in the water, solubility of oxygen in water is about 8 milligrams per liter. So that's, you know, that's enough to limit the mass of sulfate that will be released. The place you would get in trouble is if the tailings only have a small water cover on top of it. It's, you know, it's a lot of wave action. It's constantly bringing fresh water to where the salt lies. But that's, you know, I'm kind of paraphrasing what other people have done, but that's my conclusion from what I've read of their work. But as long as you have a deep water cover that's, you know, reasonably still, then it will prevent extensive oxidation.
It's kind of not really a technical question, but if these filters have a life of, say, a decade, and leachate occurred for a century, how's that going to work? How's NATO look at to maintain these things, you know, several, many decades after the mining concerns came in, kind of economically aware of this?
Yeah, that's.
Are these going to be publicly owned, or? How do you go back and try and
maintain these things? It's kind of a billion-dollar question, isn't it? So it's, and I don't. Right now, there's a lot of companies that are developing properties that are guaranteeing continual perpetual care. So their plan is to implement a closure system that will usually use a variety of different mediation or stabilization approaches, but they're on the hook for perpetual care.
I guess a related question, talk about caps, kind of caps.
Yep.
How do those work when you've got, again, the grant material
economic cycles or productivity, it seems like it makes sense if it's you're great guns and you cap it and you walk away, but if it's partial productivity, it kind of helps you go as how those caps work in practice.
Okay, good. The caps are the same as Rachyderitis. Their lifespan is really not that well known right now. So there's research going on to look at how long these things will last, but that research hasn't been going for maybe a decade or two decades.
You cap it, say a bunch of time for a while, you go out and you cap it, and then the next challenge on top of that, you part it, or if the productivity line was down by 60%, how do you work that practically?
Say at the diamond line that I showed you, their plan for closure is to put a cap on the top, a cover on the top. And they've set aside money during their first 2 years of operation to pay for that. So it's ongoing, continual bonding that's occurring. If the amount of rock they're accumulating, they're setting aside money to do their closure. And they had to set aside a large piece of, or chunk of money at the beginning before they could start operating.
So if they keep their mind a little bit open or a little bit going, they don't have to start putting the gap on, or how does that work? Because it seems like when you're talking about the importance of getting right on the first 10 years of getting on top of it, how does that work?
There's an economic advantage from the regulators to do progressive closure, to closing while you're operating. So you design your mine so it will be closed when you finish. And then you're obligated to maintain that closure system, but you're ahead of the game by planning for it before you start. That's a big problem. And particularly, if you're starting a new mine, you can set aside the money and be there. But for abandoned mines, that's a huge liability for my government and probably for yours. So.
Well, it's true. Shrubbies and other things that is on the one painting thing.
So that on the one side, the mine company's gone in and continually added limestone and fertilizer on an annual basis. On the other side, it's a little wetter and you can't get onto it as well. It's not as capable. So they haven't been as regular in maintaining that. So when we first started working there, probably more than a decade ago, both sides were in good shape. And progressively, one side is just died on. So it's become acidic enough and it's oxygen being consumed rapidly enough that it just can't sustain vegetation anymore.
A lot of these reactive wastes in what's also landfills are seem to be placed on plastic sublayers that are supposed to be impermeable and for collecting decay and so forth. Well, do you have any comments on the life expectancy of plastic underlayers since they have only been in existence for 200 years?
I think that's my comment. I don't work on that. I'm not an expert in that, so I'm trying to keep away from it. But like you said, they've only been in existence for a few years. So. And I think what you need to bear in mind is for most of those containment systems, the drainage system is an integral part of it. So the membrane itself is a component of the containment system, but it's not the containment system entirely. So it's augmented by a drainage system that keeps you from building up an excessive hydroelectric on top of it.
I'm struck by the mineral assemblage in the secondary mineral assemblage, the sulfate minerals and amorphous silicate.
Yeah.
And it's very similar to things that have been found on iridium platinum on Mars.
Yes.
And that supposedly was an acid sulfate system, likely.
It's a very similar mineral assemblage.
And so do you think that has implications then for a lot of this being biologically catalyzed and mediated in order to get a large...
This or Mars?
On Mars. On Mars. That in order to get a large acid sulfate system like that, that there needs to be biological catalysis involved.
Excuse me. Let's talk about it later. I have very firm opinions and almost no evidence.
groundwater.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah.
Beautiful place to go.
If you've got groundwater and a substantial amount of rainwater,
yes.
With the technology you've been describing, I'm not an engineer, but are we assuming we're sort of required perpetual observation, possibly perpetual care to keep the mines you're working with economic, environmentally sound?
Yes. Yes. That's true. Yeah. Places where we're using that technology is, we'd expect to have to march that well into the long term, into the future. Maybe not forever, but pretty close.
This is probably outside your level of expertise too, but you've worked in a lot of different jurisdictions. Do you have any comments on the kind of financial assurance the government requires in terms of permitting, particularly mining, not abandoned mines? You've worked in the U.S., Australia, Canadian provinces of different kinds?
It changes, and it changes in an individual place. So, where I live in Ontario, we had very rigid standards a decade ago, and they've gone down. They're not as rigid now. In the Northwest Territories, where the diamond mine was, they had no standards a decade ago, and they've gone way up. So I can't say, you know, this country's better than this, or this province is better than that. They're really variable. Overall, there's a greater awareness of the need for financial assurance. You know, and that's pretty universal. And you know, the idea that you create this problem, you need to at least help to solve it is, you know, that's pretty universal as well. But there's still corporations that walk away. You know, we had a really major problem in Canada less than a decade ago where companies went bankrupt, left a huge problem. So those are the trends that we can see. There is a greater understanding that we need to have financial assurance in it. The proponents need to be part of that. The mining companies need to be part of that. And the major mining companies agree with that. You know, they want to be able to continue to operate, and they don't want to have a legacy of bad sites on their books.
One more question regarding the location of the treatment area in relation to temperature, humidity, rainfall. Utah, southwest U.S. is much drier. Versus Minnesota and maybe southern Canada. And how much does rainfall, temperature, humidity, these things play into a reactivity? In other words, can you compare a treatment system in Utah with one in northern Minnesota or southern Canada? Because of weather and climate and those kinds of things.
Well, you need to define the groundwater flow system at a site individually very carefully. Groundwater flow is controlled, you know, really a lot by the permeability of the aquifer material. And that only has a relatively finite range. The other thing is that it's really controlled also by the amount of precipitation that falls, which is, so we see velocities that are, groundwater velocities are, a few meters to a year to a few hundred meters. So. But not much bigger range than that. So you have to tailor the reactive mixture and the size of the area to the conditions of a particular aquifer. But we do have barriers in Utah, and we do have barriers in southern Canada. And they're working. Yeah, like you have to understand the system we're working with really well.
If we've been going on for quite a while, we certainly would like to thank David for his very interesting lecture and help with the questions. And before we give them a pause here, I think there will be a gathering from who wants to come down to St. Benedict's, Sir Benedict's, in a while. We'll probably have a little informal gathering down here. So thanks very much.